You're listening to KOWS 107.3 FM in Occidental, California. Dr. Roy Idelson, PhD, is a psychologist who studies, writes about, and consults on the role of psychological issues in political, organizational, and group conflict settings. President of Idelson Consulting, past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, a member of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology, and a consulting partner in Cognitive Policy Works. Is that all still operative?
I would say that's all true. Yeah.
All right. Okay. We can't get you off the hook on any of that.
Not really. Nope.
Very interesting stuff. I think I've discovered you, I'm not sure, I think through Common Dreams you posted something of great interest. So I contacted you, and here we are going to launch into the work that you're doing. It looks very interesting to me. Where should we begin?
Lots of possibilities. We could talk about the Common Dreams piece. We can also, I'd like to take some time to talk about the framework, the psychological framework that I've been using in a lot of the social justice efforts and writing that I'm involved in.
Absolutely. What sort of psychologist are you?
I am trained as a clinical psychologist. I also have a background, I guess I'd say, in social and political psychology. But, earlier in my life, I was a practitioner working with clients, including a lot of marital therapy. Since then, I've moved on more to research and writing and less of the clinical work.
Is social and political psychology a formal field?
Social psychology is.
Yes.
Political psychology, less so, but more and more interest, I'd say, in the discipline is shifting to political issues, broadly understood. And in some ways, I think those are the most important these days.
Boy, we surely would think so. We would think that it would be important that we understand the psychological well-being of people we're about to entrust with enormous power and influence.
Yes, but beyond just our leaders, political psychology is really a domain that talks about the psychology behind politics.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just about the president or a Supreme Court justice. It's about all of us and what it is that gets in the way of kind of creating the kind of society that most of us actually want.
Yeah. Would you share briefly a little about your own personal background, where you grew up and how you got interested in this line of work?
Sure. I grew up actually about 2 miles from where I live now. And so outside of Philadelphia, in the early 50s, I guess it was, basically lived a suburban life until I went to college and then graduate school and eventually came back to the Philadelphia area. Upon returning, at that point as a psychologist, I found myself progressively more interested in social issues. And that's when I kind of shifted over time from clinical work with individuals and couples to, trying to apply psychology to bigger picture issues, through research and writing.
So let's dive in. Should we start with the framework?
Sure. I guess for the last decade or so, I've been working on a framework that tries to explain what are the key elements in how we understand the world. And I came to this because of my background, interested in both how individuals make sense of the world and how groups make sense of the world. And I was looking for, what do they share in common? And I think there are five basic issues, and I'll just mention them quickly, and then we can talk about each one, perhaps. The first is vulnerability. The second, injustice. The third, distrust. The fourth, superiority. And fifth is helplessness. And what I believe to be the case is that we view the world through these lenses, and we're especially reactive to those situations that stimulate these concerns. So in a sense, you know, this is an exaggeration, you can imagine that we wake up in the morning and we wonder these questions. Am I safe, or will I be safe? That's vulnerability. Will I be treated fairly, or am I being treated fairly? You know, and this can be at home, at work, you know, in any situation. Can I trust the people that I'm dealing with or going to be dealing with? That's the distrust angle. Superiority, the basic question is, you know, am I good enough? Am I going to be respected? And then helplessness is the question, can I make a difference? Does what I'm trying to do have a chance of succeeding? And we do this as individuals, but this is also, I believe, the dynamic that controls a lot of what happens in groups. So, in a sense, one ethnic group in conflict with another ethnic group, one religious group in conflict with another religious group, the issues that often emerge are built around vulnerability, injustice, distrust, superiority, and helplessness. And those are therefore often the levers that determine whether conflict gets worse or whether it gets better.
Conflict, of course, is normal and even necessary, yes?
Absolutely. And not all conflict is bad, right? Some conflict certainly is. Violent conflict, more so. But it's how we deal with conflict that is, in some ways, most important. When I used to do marital therapy, one of the points I would regularly try and make is that conflict in a relationship is not in and of itself a problem. It's how the couple responds to the conflict. And some couples respond in healthy ways and constructive ways, and others, you know, less so. But conflict itself is not necessarily bad. I think it's all around us.
Well, our country is fairly—I'm tempted to say—almost insane with conflict.
Yes, in certain ways, there's a lot of conflict, but in other ways, not as much as we might want or need. We seem to, in a sense, accept a lot of things at this point that should be very upsetting and the source of conflict. It's one of the, I think, particular challenges we face now in a society where inequality is so great and power is so much centered among the few, that the conflict, the positive conflict we might see in terms of exchanging ideas, debating policy decisions, doesn't involve us as much as individuals. Yeah. There's conflict in Washington, I understand, but even that doesn't seem to be producing the kind of outcomes that most of us would want. Yeah.
It seems these days that so much power is concentrated in so few hands that the phenomenon of that power, how can this best be said, pressing its advantage, relentlessly seems particularly unjust and even counterproductive. That after a certain amount of power is concentrated, that it needs to be distributed for the welfare of all, or else we're headed down a very, very dangerous and threatening path.
I agree with you, Ken. There are a couple, interesting things there. One is there's more and more research that shows that inequality in a society is bad pretty much for everyone, not just those at the short end. And as we, as power becomes increasingly concentrated among the few, inequality has grown in the United States. And it's not ultimately going to be a good thing for hardly anyone when you have, increased rates of incarceration. No one benefits from that. When you have additional mental health problems because of inequality, no one benefits from that. And this is an ongoing progressive problem we face. Part of why, from my perspective as a psychologist, the powerful are able to hold on to what they have and in fact increase it at the expense of those who are more needy, is exactly these, kind of five core issues I talked about earlier. We are especially susceptible to appeals that tap into those five issues. And these appeals are what have been used to drive us into wars that we, had no business getting into. Iraq being an example. They're also the appeals that maintain the status quo. So, just to give you a few examples, if we talk about vulnerability, well, what the powerful do, or among the things the powerful do, is they try and persuade us that what they're doing is necessary to somehow keep all of us safe, and that if these policies were not in place, the situation would be worse, that people would be at greater risk. And they tap into our fears. And partly what they do is tap into our fears of each other. If we are more worried about our neighbors and whether they they have different interests from us, we don't focus on where the real problem lies. Mm-hmm. In terms of injustice, inequality, one of the steps to addressing inequality or extreme inequality is to recognize that it's unjust. So if those in power can simply persuade us that it's not unfair, it's just the way things are, then we tend not to confront it the way we otherwise might.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of distrust, and I alluded to this earlier, I think, if the powerful can make us distrust each other so that potential coalitions that could work for positive change do not do so because they're fractured due to, distrust that's been promoted from above, the status quo continues as well. In terms of superiority, there's a long-standing effort to blame the victim, over decades. It shows itself in different ways, in different dynamics, and we see it whenever there's a crisis. If you think back to Katrina in 2005, the hurricane, there were those who blamed, the residents of the area, for not handling the situation well, for not getting out when they could. Of course, it wasn't true. They didn't have the opportunity. They didn't have the resources to leave. But we blame the victim. Poverty is a broader example. What those in power often do or say directly or indirectly is an attempt to persuade us that, well, those who are poor deserve to be poor, and those who are wealthy have earned that wealth, despite all evidence to the contrary. And the last one, in terms of helplessness, and this is really key, if we think that we cannot change the system, then we don't even try. So to whatever extent the powerful can lead us to feel powerless, we are here kind of accepting a situation that's really unacceptable, because we don't think we have a chance. We don't know what can we do to make it different.
Right. We're actively discouraged.
Yes, we absolutely are. And often it takes the form of those in power saying that they themselves have no control over the situation. You know, that this is just the course of the world. This is what globalization does. We can't stop it. We regret it, but it's not our fault. And that kind of gets into the, you know, the piece that you, I think, had read in Common Dreams, where I just tried to talk a little about a short story, a science fiction story by Ursula Le Guin. And it was written, I think, almost 40 years ago. And she just, in a few pages, a few fascinating pages, presents a fictional world of a society or a town, a community, where everyone does well. Everyone is happy. Everyone appreciates what they have. People have jobs. They have friendships. Even the weather is good. It looks like utopia. The only fly in the ointment is that it all depends on this one child who is locked up forever in a cellar and who suffers miserably. And without explanation of why, and that's, you know, what you can do in fiction, the society revolves around that. As long as that child locked up in a basement cellar continues to suffer, everything else will be good. And so she poses in the story, it becomes a question, it's provocative. Like, is that, how do we handle that? I mean, what is that, what's the right thing to do? What are the trade-offs that we need to consider? And some of the people in this town, they end up leaving. I mean, she explains that essentially they can't bear this situation. They are doing well, all is good, but the idea that they are benefiting from the suffering of someone else is just profoundly unacceptable to them. And they walk off not necessarily knowing where they're going, but just, you know, they can't do it anymore. And there's a way, in terms of the way our society is structured now, that superficially, it, you know, one could make the case, well, that's the sad part of the United States, that some people just have to suffer, that it can't be a society that works well for everyone, and there's no getting around it. And what I tried to do in just, you know, a couple pages was then point out how untrue that analogy is, because on the one hand, it's not just one child in a fantasy world suffering for the benefit of everyone. We live in a place where millions, tens of millions, are suffering for the benefit of just a relative few. So the whole thing has been turned upside down in that sense. And then second, you know, in a fictional world, you can have whatever constraints. I mean, the author can have whatever constraints he or she wants. And in this case, it was that if this child does not continue to suffer, the society will collapse. But that's not our situation either. It doesn't have to be the way it is now, where poverty is increasing, where inequality is skyrocketing, where, you know, CEOs earn, I think now, 320 times the salary of their average employees. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's making as much in one day as an employee makes in a year. Mm-hmm. So that's what I try to talk about there. And part of what's, you know, again, as a psychologist, frustrating is the way these issues are framed in Washington or by those in positions of power. We're hearing a lot about hard choices and in terms of budget decisions, and I'm sure we'll continue to. But who, hard choices for whom is the question. Those making these decisions, those deciding that, you know, jobs are secondary to budget deficits, that's not a hard choice for them to make. I mean, they're doing very well. Their lives are good. So they're imposing conditions on others, and those others, in a sense, don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. So that's not what a hard choice is.
And as you referred to earlier, their lives are really not good, or their lives are really not good.
Right. More and more of us are struggling in one way or another, either in poverty or losing, you know, not at that point yet, but losing our jobs or losing our health care. Life is much more stressful. And it's a continuing process. It's a destructive process. It potentially destroys community. People do not bounce back from these kinds of experiences as quickly, mm-hmm. As we might wish. And to make matters worse, the struggles that so many are experiencing now, up to a point, just makes it less likely that they will be able to mobilize and collectively challenge the circumstances that are oppressing them. You know, if you have to worry about finding food for your family today, that takes your time and effort, as it should. So there's a level at which if people have to struggle just for daily necessities, they're not going to be looking as much at the big picture. And mm-hmm. what I believe we really need to do is find ways to organize across, for example, economic levels in order to have a chance at changing things for the better.
Mm-hmm. Why do you call these dangerous ideas?
Well, vulnerability, injustice, distrust, superiority, and helplessness, I've called them dangerous ideas initially, and I think they still are, simply because when people focus on these issues, conflict tends to emerge. And the conflict can be negative and destructive. Even if it's positive conflict, someone is probably being put at risk. So, whether that be, in a marriage where the focus turns to issues of trust or distrust, or whether it's, between the powerful and those, the haves and the have-nots. When we focus on these kinds of issues, there's some greater danger for someone. In other words, the equilibrium becomes unstable. And where it leads depends on choices made. But in that sense, they are dangerous. And from a power perspective, those who have it don't want those who don't have it to feel injustice. They don't want them to be distrustful of those who are making decisions for them, and so on. So in that way, dangerous. It's an imperfect conception, but it tends to mean things are going to be more dynamic in one way or another.
You wrote a piece in praise of shared outrage. Would you talk to us about that?
Sure. And again, these things are linked together. I mean, there are different efforts on my part to try and communicate a broad message. But what I, in the piece about shared outrage, I think what we need today, basically, is more of this outrage. And it's the opposite of being passive. It's the opposite of accepting the world the way it is. But the outrage has to be shared. That's where the collective action comes from. What we need to find ways so that those who don't necessarily have the same experience can still have the same goals. So someone can be struggling to make ends meet, and someone else can feel that's not right. No one should have to suffer or struggle the way these individuals are. That's the basis for shared outrage. So it's somehow bringing to, in a sense, it's bringing together those who, you know, are perhaps not struggling, middle class, and those who are in worse economic shape. Those people can share a lot in common and work together for change. And it probably depends on what they can agree on is that this is an outrageous situation. And you don't have to be, you know, part of those who are most disadvantaged to feel outrage about it and to want to do something about it. These are the alliances, these are the coalitions of, you know, waiting to be born or waiting to be more fully developed against, undoubtedly, the wishes of those in power. I mean, shared outrage is a way to confront the status quo, a status quo that is working only for a few and not many. Part of why I think this outrage is important is that it has staying power. It is, it forms, in a sense, it takes two groups and creates one group. I can, as an example of what, you know, we think of and certainly is another positive emotion that doesn't work as effectively is compassion. It's good that people feel compassion for others and feel compassion for those who are less well off or who are struggling. But psychologists have determined, you know, through research of various sorts, that our capacity to feel compassion is limited in ways that, in a sense, are unfortunate, but still real. We tend to feel compassion, most compassionate, toward single individuals. And there are some interesting studies where, I may have the details wrong, but one research study where people were asked how much money would they give to help with the medical treatment of a particular child. The child is identified by name, and it's one person. And people, you know, say how much they would give, or they actually give, I think in one of these experiments, they actually give that amount of money. And in the other condition, they're shown five children who also need that same treatment, and they're asked how much will they give. And they give less. There's not less per child. The total amount to help five children is less than what they will give to help a single child. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, this is who we are as people, and our compassion just tends to be limited and not always well directed. We also know that it doesn't necessarily last. When there's a disaster, people rise to the occasion, earthquake in Haiti or whatever it may be, and people try and do something. They want to make a difference. They feel this compassion. But then it passes. And it's the outrage that I think is important, because it has lasting power, because it continues for as long as the injustice continues, potentially. Mm-hmm. So it's an ongoing thing, and you can build a movement around it. If you can get people to recognize their common concerns, their common interests, and their common sense of what is morally right, and that drives and creates the outrage. And those who don't want to see change, their goal is to see if, you know, the citizenry can be kept from experiencing outrage. And this goes back to those five appeals. We can be made to think that it will be that we should be afraid of change, that we'll become more vulnerable if, you know, we try and alter the system. We can be persuaded that, well, it's not unfair. Yes, you think this is an injustice, but, you know, trust us. It's not that it's unfair. It's just unfortunate. This is the way the world is. And in fact, the people who are accusing us of not caring about all of you, they're the ones who are being unfair. They're mistreating us. Again, coalitions depend on some level of trust, and those in power will do what they can to emphasize or create reasons for us not to trust each other. And they're very effective at it. It's part of what being powerful in an unequal society is about. You have tremendous resources. To a large extent, you have the media to use as you think best, or for your needs. And it's just really tough, therefore, to create change. I mean, we are in a difficult period, undoubtedly, very difficult.
Is our moral sense moribund?
Well, I don't think so. It's like we're fighting uphill, because we have to both feel this outrage and think that we can do something about it. And neither of those, the combination is tough, because, you know, you or I or anyone else can be, you know, really upset about something we see, we read about, and we can be, and I think we are outraged. I think we're outraged, even though their efforts to keep us from experiencing that. But in addition, the question is, so what can we do? You know, and that's where it gets difficult, because we can feel helpless. We can feel that this is awful, but I'm not big enough to make a difference. This is why we got to work on it together. I mean, there's I don't think there's any doubt about that. And not only are we stronger, much stronger together in organizing ourselves, but it also means that no single individual, no single group is at heightened risk. In other words, we can share the risk. If there are going to be, you know, negative reactions, there are going to be efforts to thwart what we're doing, the consequences are shared as well. I think, I mean, what's your view on where we stand?
Well, I think we are fast asleep, cowardly, irresponsible, self-obsessed, and I would like to I'm an excitable boy.
Uh-huh.
And I'm outraged beyond outraged. I'm outraged to the point of sickness. I'm sick about the world we live in, and as far as I'm concerned, it all comes back to us. And I'm tired of blaming the politicians and the corporations and everything else under the sun except our own sleepwalking, cowardly humanity. So does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I think I understand your perspective, and I share it to some extent. I do think there are challenges we face to be our better selves, and that you know, many things are lined up against us and strategically against us. That said, you know, we are one in terms of feeling that we need to do something, that you know, excuses are insufficient, and certainly things are not going to get better if we don't try. It's tough when people turn inward when they're struggling or experiencing despair, but that's not at all, you know, psychologically unusual or unexpected. And the more we fragment as a community, the less we're going to be engaged in putting things back together. Mm-hmm. But I don't disagree with the... I guess I'm not as... I don't know if you're describing pessimism or depression, Ken. But
I'm wildly optimistic. I think nothing is stacked up against us that we can't respond to successfully, courageously, with great passion and inspiration and love and generosity and cooperation. I think everything that we use as an excuse why we can't or won't or don't is just an excuse, and I think it's lame, and I don't have much patience for it or much respect for it either.
Mm-hmm. I think there are opportunities. You know, I do tend to appreciate the, you know, the sense of demoralization that I think a lot of people have experienced. And that's tough to, that can be tough to overcome. And we do need to. But again, I guess I would emphasize that it's something that we have to do together. And some people, it takes leaders also. I mean, people need to stand up and essentially, you know, there's a scene in Network where the broadcaster says everyone should go to their windows and stick their heads out and say, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And that's the, in a sense, the outrage I'm describing, but it's got to be collective outrage and it's got to be shared outrage for it to be effective. So we need to find, you know, whether it's locally or nationally, ways to gather ourselves together and resist what's happening. And the, you know, one of the examples that people often refer to as a case of, I'm asked, well, isn't the Tea Party an example of shared outrage? I mean, look what they have accomplished. Well, you know, I'm not pleased with what they've accomplished, but in part, they did it through massive funding from those in positions of power. You know, that it's started as an AstroTurf movement designed to appear as though, you know, it's kind of citizen activism, and it's, in that sense, it's regrettable. It's a poor example of what I'm describing, because those individuals, from, you know, what I have seen, what from my reading, it's not about outrage shared that they share with those who are less fortunate. I mean, Tea Partiers are by and large middle class or upper middle class, white, often college educated, and mostly men. And they're not the ones who, in fact, are the source of such difficulty, you know, in our country today. But, you know, they have their movement, they have their power, and it's in some ways frightening to see what they're doing with it, as, you know, just watching a Republican debate makes clear.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Idelson, do you need to tell us about the individual group belief inventory?
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I'll just mention that as part of my research, I did develop a self-report measure where people can rate themselves on these five kind of core beliefs: vulnerability, injustice, distrust, superiority, and helplessness. It's, if people are interested, it's available. I think you can download it from my website, which is idelsonconsulting.com. That's E-I-D-E-L-S-O-N. But it, among the things the inventory does is it can be used, including for research, to capture how individuals feel about their own personal world, the extent to which they feel vulnerable or they feel mistreated. But there's also a version that can capture how people feel about the groups they belong to. So, for example, you know, someone can answer it in terms of their national group, let's say the United States. And in that case, you know, the questions are, do you feel that the United States is endangered? Do you feel the United States needs to be distrustful of other countries? Do you feel the United States is better than other countries? And different scores. You know, people differ in how, and I've done many studies with this, they differ in how they rate themselves and how they describe their beliefs about the United States or some other group. They differ from each other, and you can predict things based on how people score on these inventories. Not surprisingly, just as one example, people who more strongly believed that the United States is mistreated, needs to be distrustful, and is superior to other countries, they were strong supporters of the invasion of Iraq. To the extent individuals did not hold those beliefs about the United States, they were much less supportive of the invasion. So part of what happens, I mean, what this is consistent with, is when there is a push to war, which is, you know, what the Bush administration engaged in, what is happening in part is people are being persuaded to see their group, the United States, through a certain lens. And that lens is that we are at risk as a people, that we have been mistreated, that we cannot trust, you know, other groups, that we're better, you know, that we're morally superior, we're exceptional. And in terms of helplessness, the belief is we are not helpless, that we can do what has to be done. And the more you can get, you know, Americans to hold those beliefs, the more ready they are to support war. And the manipulation worked in 2003 and leading up to 2003.
What is Idelson Consulting, and what kind of work are you doing in the world?
Well, Idelson Consulting is a small operation looking to apply psychology for progressive purposes. And what this involves is some consulting with other organizations, research I'm doing related to these dangerous ideas, core beliefs, and writing at this point, and speaking engagements and things like that. So I do have a book, something that may someday be a book that kind of covers this in greater depth, and that takes some of my time, but also a lot of the work I do is through other organizations now, and you mentioned a couple at the beginning. One is Psychologists for Social Responsibility. That the website is psysr.org. And that's an effort, that's an organization, it's actually been around about 30 years. I'm the past president. But what we try and do is take psychology and apply it to the world situation or to issues of social justice, either through actions or creating educational materials or statements of support for one position or another. There's a lot of information on the website that people may find interesting, and it's an organization not limited only to psychologists, but it was called Psychologists for Social Responsibility 30 years ago, and we haven't changed the name. And the other group is the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology, and that website is ethicalpsychology.org, and that's a smaller organization or group of us trying to, how would I put it, bring back stronger ethics to the profession of psychology. So a group of us got together in response to deep concerns about psychologists involved in interrogations at Guantanamo and secret black sites, and these were interrogations that amounted to torture by any reasonable definition. And we have tried in various ways, to get psychologists out of those situations, to kind of take a stand against the position of the American Psychological Association, which has insisted that psychologists have a useful role to play in those settings. And we think not. And we think the evidence is clear that that they haven't served that role, and that a profession that's supposed to focus foremost on healing and doing no harm has no business supporting these types of interrogations. So I do a variety of different things, and it does keep me busy.
Mm-hmm.